After we met in Headington last time, I thought that I would like to ask you some questions about Russia and start with your last visit. I think it's worth doing. I mean, just even that to try and record many of the things that happened to you in this meeting, and that will be a starting point for another. So, have you got here a copy of Personal Impressions?
In this room, no.
Because, you see, when I prepared this meeting, I needed it, because I didn't remember what was in your chapter on Akhmatova.
Correct.
On what I think I heard from you.
Yes.
So I'll check it before next
week. Very good, very good.
I didn't find it at home, it's too late.
You've got it here.
No, I didn't find it at home here. I know, I don't have it here. But now I have time to take it.
But pick it up on Friday when you come.
Well, we have time before next week.
Pick it up on Friday.
All right. Because we'll come to Akhmatova. Now, the journey started with the idea of going with Alfred Brendel to his concerts, or...?
Well, I'll tell you. Yes, you did. Exactly. For years, I didn't want to go back. I never thought and knew whether I'd get a visa or not. I was lost in Russia in 56.
Yes.
But then I was a guest of the British ambassador, and therefore I got a visa. But I decided I was a persona non gratissima in the Soviet Union, because I've been attacked more than once in Soviet papers by name. I'm regarded as a Sovietologist, which I'm not. I've never been, never wished to be, never, I didn't much believe in the profession. But anyhow, I'm not, but they regard me as an unfriendly Sovietologist.
What were the attacks?
Oh, I mean, from the very beginning. When I came back in 45, I'd broadcast a piece by the famous Russian 19th century critic, Belinsky. And I said that his attitude to the West was one of ambivalence, love and hatred. I was then duly attacked in Pravda, in the leading article, which also attacked Toynbee and various other people, for saying a certain Berlin, an enemy of all true culture, says that Belinsky was ambivalent. So that is not true. He loved what was good and hatred was bad. A very different matter. And this is a typical sort of Western attitude of a pervert of the facts. So I knew I was not very popular after my visit in 45. I didn't quite know why, but that was so. That was quite early on. Must have been 47, I mean, that sort of period. Then, for example, I always occurred in the list of people who, as it were, the perverters of Soviet thought and history in the West. In the previous catalogues, with Leonard Shapiro, I don't know, God knows who in England, various other, I don't know, Bolsover, all these sort of people, I always occurred in that, used to occur in that sort of list. So I could see there was an animus against me. Largely, I think, because, probably because of the visit of Akhmatova in the end, because of Stalin's personal rage. Yes, but that's probably part of the reason. But anyway, also because I served in the British Embassy, and that in itself was enough. And because, I suppose, when I met Russians in Soviet Union then, I didn't appear to be over-sympathetic from the point of view. They were quite right to judge me as non-friend. Then, Venturi wrote a book called On Russian Populism. And I was asked to write the introduction to the English translation, which is called The Roots of Populism or something. And... Populismo Russo. And I there made disparaging of what they thought were two things. First of all, I said the Narodniks, to some extent, were a quasi-religious movement. And then I also said something perhaps not entirely friendly about Lenin. So the review of the book, which was extremely favorable, said, at that time Venturi was very well thought of, no longer, but at that time he was regarded as a great friend. Said, of course, quoting a Russian proverb, there's no barrel of honey or mead without a spoonful of tar. The British government would never have allowed this book to be published in England if this introduction had not been attached to it. by the rotors. And then said, he says monstrous things like this, that, and the other. Then the monstrous things were acquitted. So I could see it. I was not, mind you, in 56, I did talk to the collection of philosophers. And I dare say there, one or two of them afterwards said to people like Jacobs and other Russian scholars that my attitude appeared highly reactionary. So from all this I gleaned that I was not exactly adored. And so then I thought, well, a very nice to go with Brendel, good opportunity. Why not? I suddenly felt enthusiasm for getting there again and got Batrov and all that. And then I thought, what should I do? Should I apply for a visa? And I consulted John Roberts, who is the director of the Great Britain USSR SSE, which is the official body of cultural relations, on the committee which I am, in theory. And he said, no, we can't just apply for a visa as a tourist. No, we must do better than that. And then he wrote to the British ambassador, who then invited us to stay. I knew then that I would get a visa because guests of an ambassador, they wouldn't refuse. I wasn't quite black enough for that. And then he asked me, the ambassador, whether I would invite the Brendels also to stay. And they accepted. So we all stayed together. That's how I came to go.
Now, what were the concerts?
He was originally invited to give four concerts in Moscow and four in Leningrad. They cut that down to one concert in Moscow and two in Leningrad.
Why?
Don't know, who can tell. Gosconcert, this organization, they were terribly inefficient. Terribly inefficient, and they annoyed him in all kinds of ways by not providing what they promised. And then he went to the conservatoire also in Moscow, where he was a great success. The students applauded him. The concert was wild success in Moscow. I thought it was pretty successful in Leningrad also, but he thought that there was a certain coolness in the front rows. The front rows were entirely occupied by commissars, so perhaps it was natural enough. I mean, by sort of officials, various kinds, who were obviously there more or less for official reasons.
I mean, he didn't play with orchestra.
No.
Recitals.
He played recitals, yes. And then he gave two concerts in Leningrad, both of which I went. Third one after we left. That was because he was supposed to give a concert in the Yusupov Palace in Leningrad, which has a private theatre, built probably in the 80s or 90s, full of gold and velvet and exquisite private theatre. But the piano was as old as the theatre, 80 years old, he said, couldn't play it. They produced another piano, equally, bad. So then he gave an extra concert somewhere else to make up for it, that I didn't hear. So he gave three concerts in Leningrad in the end. But he was very, he was well treated otherwise. I mean, he was respectfully treated, but they always failed to do this, failed to do that, and so on.
Did he meet other pianists? Musicians?
He must have done. But he met other musicians, yes. When in the conservatoire, people came up to him, players of instruments, and asked for this and that question and tried to. There was one, but he was a girl, he's 12, who played the piano, whose father, who seemed to be quite mad, wanted him to get her to England or America. I don't think he's done that. A kind of Louis. She was a kind of child prodigy, who played very well in a kind of mechanical way.
Now, were there other musical events when you were there? No,
none. None that
no,
I...
Opera, oh, well, let ballet, me... No.
Wait, I may be telling you an untruth. Let me try and think. Yes, there were.
But you didn't go?
Yes.
Ah, you did.
I went to the Bolshoi Theatre to hear some kind of something for the ballet schools, or some kind of concert in for the benefit of some and then I isolated items, bits and pieces. I didn't see an opera, no. And in Leningrad, we, in the hotel, I made friends with an Armenian violinist. So I went to hear his particular chamber music group, and they played quite nicely.
What kind of repertoire?
Oh, perfectly classical repertoire.
Classical.
Some Russian, I mean, Haydn, Mozart, Tchaikovsky, Prokofiev, that kind of thing.
Now, I remember some meetings that you had there, and I'll ask you about them. If I miss something of importance, you will tell me. Now, you met a certain Lichachev is his name?
Lichachev.
Lichachev.
In Oxford.
He's an historian of the early church period.
He's an historian of early Russia, yes. And the late Byzantium, yes. And early Russia, yes.
Now, you met him only in Oxford?
Only in Oxford.
Ah, I see. So all what you tell me about him...
Entirely comes from conversation here.
He came here to get his honorary degree?
No, he already had it. In Oxford, he had one. I think he just came here because he was invited. And he went to various British universities. He picked up an honorary degree in St. Andrews. But he's certainly the most eminent living Russian historian living in Russia.
When did he come here?
He came here this year. He came here before to get his degree. After, they wouldn't let him out. He went to a labor camp in the 30s. In the 20s. Late 20s, I think. And he was attacked by so-called bandits in Leningrad about 5 or 6 years ago and wounded. His papers were taken away. He was very badly treated in Leningrad. But now he's head of the cultural organization which looks after cultural values in Russia, of which Gorbachev's wife is the vice president. So he's suddenly been lifted and suddenly been rescued. That's why he was... When I was president of the British Academy, I used to invite him practically every year and always the same letter arrived. Mission Nikachov is unwell, Mission Nikachov is abroad, can't come. He got none of the letters, not a single one.
But I think you told me that he told you a very interesting story about he was suspected to be mentally not in order because...
That's right.
So what were they exactly?
I'll tell you exactly. He was invited to Moscow to a meeting.
He's from Leningrad.
He's a professor in Leningrad. And the academician and so on. Retired, I think. He's 83. And he was summoned together with others to some meeting to be addressed by Gorbachev. He went, arrived rather late, with the consequence that he had a chair at the back of the room near a rather narrow door. Gorbachev did his stuff and then began to go out, followed by entourage, and then saw him and asked how he was, recognized him, asked him if he was writing anything, talked to him about 5 minutes or 10 minutes, very, very respectfully and well. He said he remembered it very well. Leningrad was obviously extremely well disposed. And then left. He went back to Leningrad. Then about 2 or 3 weeks later, he was telephoned to by the authorities, presumably by the Soviet or whatever it was, and governing body, saying, would you mind, after all, Professor Gorbachev, you're not as young as you used to be, you were born and grew up here, would you mind having a medical examination? To which he said, no, but I don't think I need it, but still. He does suffer from various diseases, of course, at his age. And so then the doctor came, and the doctor said, Academician Gorbachev, did anything abnormal happen? Did you have the honor of meeting the general secretary of the Soviet Communist Party? Yes, I did. Did anything abnormal happen at the time? He said, no, I don't think so. No. Something did. What was it? He then learned from the doctor that the account he got from his authorities was that not that Gorbachev stopped Lichachev, but that Lichachev stopped Gorbachev and kept him in front of the door for 10 minutes while nobody else could get out. And this was so abnormal that would he mind having a mental examination? It was clear he was not quite normal. Even now. Of course, he is very unpopular with the Communist Party in Leningrad. Not a credible story, is it?
Really?
So in spite of his great eminence, he presumably, I think he was probably asked a few questions, I don't think he was given shock treatment.
Yeah. No, but still.
This is a fantastic story, isn't it?
You met Sakharov at the embassy?
No. Sakharov wouldn't come to the embassy. No, we went to see him in his own flat. Aline and I, and then the young secretary of the embassy, who more is accompanied us. Do I not tell you that story?
You tell me shortly when we met at your place.
Well, is he well? Well, there was a very boring Italian ambassador, the Italian ambassador in Cairo, who had been in Moscow, I think, who spoke Russian quite well. He asked him general questions such as a Western journalist would ask, like, do you feel hope for the future? Do you think Russia is making progress? Do you think things will be easier? So on. He answered in very general terms. He obviously liked him, knew him as a friend. I intervened once or twice, but it was terribly boring. His wife, in the meanwhile, yes, his wife, in the meantime, was there and rather didn't know who we were, looked rather cross, and brought in a cup of tea, and then talked a little bit about her own past, told us that she was the daughter of Mikoyan's best friend. She's Armenian, half Jewish, half Armenian.
Her name is Bonar.
No, that's the second, yes, second husband, must be the first husband's name. She's an Armenian.
She's Armenian.
The father was Armenian, mother was Jewish. So that's an unusual combination. It was clear that she was brought up in Comintern circles. The father must have been something to do with the Comintern, because she lived next door to the Tolyatti family. She liked Tolyatti. She didn't like Kusinin, who was in the head of the Comintern, who she thought was a terrible man. Her father was arrested in 37, I think, and she rushed off to see Mikoyan. He said, I know your father is my best friend, but only Stalin or, what's his name, Yezhov can do anything. Nobody else can do anything with him. No use, okay, going to none of us with the slightest influence. But if you like, I'll adopt you. But she declined. If you could take my name, you will live with me. It was kindness. I wish it didn't. Survived. Father was shot in 38. And that's still the story. And then I don't know, there was a kind of silence. Then she finally got rather impatient with us and asked the young man who we were. So he wrote down my name.
She didn't know.
No idea.
And Sakharov knew?
No.
Who you were? No.
No idea. From the British Embassy, people from the British Embassy. No idea. But then she asked for a name, and so he wrote down the name. And then she said, ah, you knew Akhmatova. And then it came to life. She said, I'm a tremendous admirer.
She or
she. She had nothing to do with this.
I see. Ah.
And then she began talking very freely. And he warmed up. And he said, what do you do? I said, I teach philosophy. Who are the best philosophers these days? Who are the important modern philosophers? I said, well, I suppose you could say Wittgenstein. He said, what did he say? That was a little more difficult. I tried to convey what the Tractatus was about, first work. And I said, it was rather like Leibniz, certain respects. Ah, yes, Leibniz, I've heard of him. He more or less said. But we went on. But the whole atmosphere is completely transformed.
Which means the boredom was not, he was blasé, I mean,
Well, people, foreigners come to see him.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
And when he doesn't know who they are.
It was
totally changed.
Now, did he inquire about Akhmatova? I mean...
No, not particularly about Akhmatova herself.
Now, why did Akhmatova do the trick? I mean, what does Akhmatova mean to them?
Because she's an icon.
No.
She's a sacred figure.
She's a sacred figure among this circle.
In the entire intelligentsia.
Now, despite the fact that she
not this circle.
In a way...
That makes no difference.
No,
she was never even seen. She got an official state funeral. She lay in state. She was not like Pasternak. She was denounced by Zhdanov. But in the end, for example, the head of the Writers' Union, who was an absolute scoundrel, called, I don't know, I forgot his name, I knew him quite well. He patronized her in order to annoy Pasternak, largely. But anyhow, she became somehow, Pasternak could not be made that because he was a Jew. And because she was a mystical figure, etc., and purely Russian, she became a kind of sacred figure.
Since when? She became a sacred figure.
Since the beginning of the war. People learned her poems by heart, just as they learned his poems. And the people in the army did that. You see, she was disapproved of course, in the late 40s, because of Zhdanov, and her bread card was taken away, and so on. But people always knew all the great poetess of that name. She became a sacred figure, I would say, certainly not while Stalin was alive, I suppose in the 60s, when suddenly they felt they had this great woman amongst them. She was very severe. She was grand, she was severe, she was lifted above the crowd, she lived a kind of very highly isolated personal life. All that made a deep impression. She made no public appearances at that time.
Now,
partly because of her poems too, poem Requiem began to go from hand to hand. Now it's been published officially, which was a poem about the horrors of the 30s. Now, of course, it's quite fashionable. You see, it's a very good story. What they all knew was she was standing in the queue to send a parcel to her son, who had been exiled, because she was married, you see, originally to a poet called Gumilev. Oh, I forgot the name of the bad Soviet heiress of the Soviet Union, Surkov. Yes, he was a real sort of tough policeman, but now a bad poet. Now, what happened was that Gumilev, of course, was a more better poet than she was, who was accused of taking part in the monarchist plot and was shot by the Cheka quite early. And Gorky wouldn't intervene on his behalf. Gorky didn't behave nearly as well as his common result. And not always, at least. And then she went into total retirement. And her son was called Gumilev, was, I think, exiled in the 30s for being called Gumilev. I think it's roughly all of us do it, on the Yezhov. And she tried to send a parcel and was standing in this long queue, all these women who had relations, they didn't quite know where, in various camps. And then a woman approached her and said, "What do you do? I'm a writer. Will you write about this one day?" said the woman in the queue. She said, "Yes, I will." And that's the origin of the poem. That was known. It touched people. She somehow stood for the conscience of Russia, in a way in which Pasternak also did, but Pasternak was much more showy, and much more, you see, and much more brilliant, much more ambitious. In a way. She was kind of a Stalin called a nun. She lived in retirement, was obviously religious.
Now, when you, what did they know about you and Akhmatova?
Who is they?
Mrs. Bonar.
Nothing. Bonner, nothing. She knew, oh, what did she know? She knew, certainly. She knew what...
Because, what
did Romer ask? She knew, I think she knew what was in my book.
What was in your book?
I think so.
I see.
That's what began it.
They knew it from you.
Now, and they also knew, if anyone who moved in those, in distant circles, knew that she had written four poems about our meeting, that I was one of the dedicatees of our greatest, famous poem, which was called Poem Without a Hero. There were two Russians and me, and the Soviet Union, my name, was never published. That these people knew.
So now, that was a poem that was published in the early 50s or something?
Oh, no, it wasn't published at all.
Ah, it was not published?
No, in America.
When was it published in America?
I would think, I can't tell you precisely, I should think the 60s, 70s, by Struve in California.
In Russian?
In Russian, yes.
Was it translated, by the way?
Yes. Frequently.
Akhmatova was translated, Holler was translated into English?
No.
I want to find it.
You'll find the poem, yes.
I had to...
In England, you'll find it in the Bodleian or something. Or in the Tellurian.
And...
Certainly.
So it was published in Russian in America.
That's right.
And how could they know that you were one of the heroes?
Well, because that went from hand to mouth, from mouth to mouth. That was the thing which was known in her circle. All these people knew each other. The whole dissident world were in contact with each other. And certainly, Madame Mrs. Bonner was one of them.
And people abroad knew that you were one of the heroes, let's say, critics of Russian literature.
Not all. I don't know who knew and who didn't.
It was, nobody mentioned it in an article or something that you were one of the...
No. I don't think so. The only article which mentioned it was something which I was violently indignant about. That was Michael Strait, whom I met in his mother's house in Dartington, which is a school they supported. And I told him the story of going to visit her and seeing a large portrait of her by Modigliani above her mantelpiece in Moscow, in Leningrad, portrait of Akhmatova.
You saw it at whose place?
In Akhmatova's flat.
Yes.
Portrait of Modigliani by Modigliani of her. She had a close relationship with him in 1912, I think.
In
Paris. She went to Paris, yes. Yes, I asked her what Modigliani was like. Small red-haired Jew, she said. But anyway, that's it, May. And then I said to Abbott, did she know that he was dead and world famous? She claimed to know neither. I didn't think that was quite genuine, because Ilya Ehrenburg could have told all that. In constant touch with those circles. Because we were still. And I told the story to Michael Strait, and then he published it in the New Republic. And that, I thought, might do her harm. She was then alive. I mean, this is in the 50s. That's the only time.
That's the story about Modigliano. Modigliani.
Well, but my being, but my knowing, at least.
Nothing else.
So I can't tell you. I don't know.
Until
I don't think so. There wasn't much about her anyway in the Western press.
Yeah, there was much. I have to check what was there was in Israel, because she was a kind of a hero.
My piece about her, which just has been translated into Russian, in Scripta Hiero Solimitana of the Hebrew University.
That's the translation.
Into Russian.
And that's the way it came to Russia in Russia?
That I can't tell. Probably smuggled by somebody. But now, the bit about her in that essay is, I think, going to be included in a volume dedicated to her.
In Russia.
In Russia.
I mean
correspondence with somebody.
I see. So until now, the whole knowledge of what was published about her in the West, anyway, and your story was just in a hearsay?
Yes, yes. Largely.
And as you said, she knew that you, which means the intelligentsia in Soviet Russia knew many things that were published about her in the West.
Well, the things get smuggled through. Not much was published about her in the West. She's been tremendously published about the last 10, 15 years, but not before that.
Let's come back now to your meeting. When you went in 45, did you make a list whom you wanted to meet? Or did
no.
How did you?
That I told that my story.
You did?
You will read that.
So I didn't remember. So I have to read. I see. Uh-huh. It was not you asking.
In no way.
Yes. Now, in your story, I read it, but I don't remember whether...
I tell the whole thing, how I came to meet her, yes.
And the description of the meeting is all there?
It's there, yes.
And the aftermath, that she blamed you for her sufferings and that you started
no,
the war?
No, that's there, yes.
It's there?
Yes.
Because I didn't
well, even in the poem, I'm called Guest of the Future.
So I'll read it first.
What is not there is that she was terribly angry when I married.
That you found out when she came here?
Yes. No. I discovered that when I talked on the telephone in 56.
You talked to her on the telephone from here?
No, from Moscow in Moscow.
Your second visit.
Yeah, that's right.
And what was her reaction? I mean, you...
I'll tell you that. No. I'll tell you what happened. She gave an account of this to a lady called Chukovskaya, who wrote two huge volumes of memoirs about her.
Chukovskaya?
She's the daughter of Chukovsky, whom I saw in Moscow this time.
Now, we'll come to her.
Two huge volumes of reminiscences of Akhmatova, kind of diary. The account she gave to her is inaccurate.
Inaccurate?
Yes. It's rather more hostile to me than the truth. What happened was, we arrived in 56. There was more or less the year in which I married Aline. And I went to see Pasternak. We both did. And he said, look, Anna Andreevna is here. You can't talk, see her, because her son has just been returned from Siberia after three exiles. And she's very nervous about meeting foreigners at the moment, quite naturally. But you can talk to her on the telephone. I'll give her a number, because that's listened to. You see, it's monitored. So, I mean, she knows what she's saying. There can't be any doubt about what goes on. You can see her, that'll be more awkward. You see? So I said, all right. And I telephoned. Instructed by Pasternak. Now I can give you both versions, hers and mine. Her version was to Chukovskaya, which is in her book, which has been translated into French. I'm not sure whether into English, maybe. A certain person telephoned to me. You know who I mean. Yes? I know, because we must have talked about this to people. The first thing he said was that he was married. I said, think, he said, the thing to say to me, that he was married. What the thing to say? I said to him, congratulations. He said, thank you, it was amusing. We didn't talk very long. What a thing to say. The true story is this. I telephoned her and she said, Pastor Nak tells me that you were married. I said, it's true. When were you married? This year. In what month were you married? I told her. Then there was brief silence. He said, I congratulate you. Very curled voice. She then said, I can't see you because for reasons which Boris has told you. So I said, I quite understand. She then said, a book by me has just been published of Korean poetry. Selection of Korean verse. Selection, not selected by me. You know, you can imagine how much Korean I know. So I said, well, could I read it? I will send it to you. We needn't trouble. I said, it's perfectly legal now. It's out. I'll certainly forward you a copy for you. They just talked quite amiable for a bit. And that was the end of it. But I realized then that she was furious. Because I played a part in her mythology. It was none of my business. We were separated by land and sea. Should have remained so. Great vulgarity on my part to marry. And a direct, somehow, destruction of some tremendous myth which he spun. You see, they were both in some way trans-historical figures. They suddenly reduced me to some kind of bourgeois happiness. It was not my business. When she came here, she was extremely cold to Aline. Very, very chilly. Alright with me.
Pardon?
Quite alright with me. Talked in a very intimate way.
Now, again, I'll read the article.
But she told the man in Leningrad, in Moscow, who I've just seen, a poet, you know very well, he lives in a palace.
He lives in a palace?
Yes.
That was her description about... She came to dinner?
Yes, she did, yes. Yes, he lives in a palace. Golden cage. That is not where intellectuals should live.
And that you were told now?
Now.
By a poet when you heard?
Yes.
And you...
I can see that she was upset.
Now, when you...
No, but I'll tell you. Her conception of me and her was quite simple. She told people that. And I think she wrote about it too. And that was Dido and Aeneas, if you know what I mean. Yes, she didn't burn herself, which Dido did. Zidona Yenye, in Russian. I was Aeneas. She did something like it. I was Aeneas. I came, we had this tremendous relationship, then I abandoned her. I had a friend called Halpern in London, who was one of the secretaries of the provisional government, who was a lawyer, a Jewish lawyer, in Russia, who then afterwards lived in England. And he had a niece still living in Moscow, or Leningrad, I can't tell which. His wife, who was a Georgian princess after he died, wrote her a letter about something else, mentioned my name. And the niece wrote back and said, he must be a very bad man. And she wrote back and said, why is he very, must he be a very bad man? Because he abandoned Akhmatova. And so Salome Halpern said to me, I don't know about your own works, but there is no doubt that you have immortality in Russia. Of that there can be no doubt. Your Russian literature has immortalized you.
Now, in Tchaikovskaya's book, how does she describe your meeting in 45 with Akhmatova?
She doesn't.
Which means you appear in the book only in this part?
Only as a telephone conversation. I think perhaps the book doesn't cover those years. I'm not sure. It's in two and a half. I think there's some misunderstanding in the middle. And nothing is covered then.
Because you see, the dialogue is
nothing.
There.
Nothing. It doesn't report it. So, it was too secret and she didn't write it down. It's not there. Nothing is said.
How incredible.
What they know from me. From my article. What the Russians know, yes. They know entirely from IPs.
Yes. No, but let's say Chukovskaya.
But when the great critic, at least I call him great critic, what is his name? Zhirmunsky was a famous critic, already began before the First World War. When he came to see me in Oxford, he came to the palace, all right. He told me exactly which poems had dealt with my visit.
He did?
Well, he was a great friend of hers, and he wrote about her. He did, yes. And I say that in that piece, when I say the list of poems which have relevance are the following. But I wish to say no more about that. I say. That's what I say in the article.
Yeah, you see, you told me bits and pieces about it.
Yes, yes. In Russia, the impression, I'm sure, or knew must be that I had some kind of affair with her. It's very far from being true.
Where will it be?
People think that.
People think, yes. No, I know. I have to read again.
I think we better, yes.
Yes, because... Now, who else did you meet there, in the embassy or?
I'll tell you, the Russians I met were Chukovskaya.
Did you ask to meet her?
Yes. Well, I met this young poet, you see, he's not yet very young now, was a friend of Akhmatova's.
In Leningrad?
In Moscow.
In Moscow.
He lives in Moscow. And he gave me, I think, the telephone number of Chukovskaya. So I telephoned her, or maybe I had it already from people in London, from the USSR, Great Britain, and follow these people. So I went to see her, and I saw her and her daughter, Chukovsky's granddaughter, and so on. And the evening with her, I didn't stay long enough. She was annoyed because I was only there for about 2 hours. She wanted me to go on and on and on, but I thought, the chauffeur, well, I don't know. Yeah. I was sorry not to go on. She was very interesting.
It was interesting.
Oh, yes. And then...
She was open, she was...
Oh, talks very freely and very openly, and completely, fearlessly. Oh, absolutely. She's 83. I said to her, why is Herzen? Why is everything called after Herzen in this country? After all, he hated communism, and he particularly detested Karl Marx. She said, because Lenin said he was friendly to the First International. That was a lie. It was one of Lenin's many lies.
That she said?
Yes.
That it was a lie.
Total lie, yes, of course. Typical lie. She had written a little book on Herzen herself, which she sent me. You see, before I ever saw her. I will tell you, I went to the Herzen Museum.
In Leningrad.
In Moscow.
Oh, in Moscow?
Yes.
It's in Moscow.
Uh-huh. Okay, Herzen Museum in Moscow. Uh-huh. That's where he lived.
There is a museum.
It's rather small and not very real. Yes, there is a Herzen Museum. One or two manuscripts, not much. Photographs of paintings of his friends, all the works of Voltaire, because he read them. I mean, it's a pretty thin affair. But still, I went there, and I didn't tell anyone that I was going. And then the director, who was a young woman, about 30, 35, came in and said, to my surprise, said, is your name Berlin? Yes. Are you the person who has written about Herzen in England? I said, yes. How wonderful. Then she was alone. But the first person in the West, really, to celebrate Herzen as he should have been. You see, in our time, we're all very pleased and so delightful. Excellent. In spite of all the heretical things I said. I said, so what about E.H. Carr? After all, he wrote a thing called The Romantic Exiles. That name may not be mentioned here. Because it was a very ironical picture. Oh, yes. It was not friendly. It made him out to be kind of... absurd, Russian, romantic, ridiculous. I call her a bit mad. I mean, not mad, but it is sort of amusing stories about him, not serious. You see, but I was all right. And then she took me about and gave me a present of two books. I was very well treated. Question is, how did she know it was my name? I didn't tell anyone. She must have passed the chauffeur, who is, of course, in KVD. KGB. Large British Embassy car stopped outside. So now that was reported immediately by the people sitting. the garderobe people to her. That's why she came in to see me.
Now, this lady read English, read French?
No, I don't. But I can't tell you.
Now, why read?
But she certainly knew.
But surely.
None of my work has been translated.
Now, why would they really bother to have a museum on Earth?
Because Lenin said the Decembrists work Herzen and he work us. He's in perfect order, Herzen. He's the father of the revolution. The fact they hated Marx and hated communism is ignored.
Now, why did Lenin say it?
Because he meant it. Because Herzen did publish the first really illegal anti-Tsarist journal in England. He was counter-revolution, counter-Tsarist propaganda, of a very intense kind.
So why did Chukovskaya say that Lenin lied?
Because Lenin said he was favorable to the First International. That is untrue.
That's what I was asking.
Yes. That was a lie. Otherwise it was a statement of fact. When Lenin said, Herzen will work us, well, if you like to say that, he couldn't. That is a false statement. Well, there wasn't a statement of fact. So much. Because they need ancestors. Herzen was a socialist. He was a marvelous writer in the Russian Revolutionary Movement. Of course, canonized him. He was a father of the Russian Revolution in some sense. In fact, he loathed communism. He's neither here nor there. He just happened to believe in individual liberty.
And now, what else did you discuss with Chukovsky?
Oh, goodness, I can't remember. I think Noel. We talk about everything. Akhmatova, a great deal about her. How she died, where she was staying, what the illness was, how people tried to save her, where she was, what she wrote at the time, mainly that, and about her father.
Chukovsky?
Yes. He was a friend of mine, sort of. I knew him.
You knew him in
45? And then he got a degree here, too. In Oxford, I managed it. Oh, so he got him here.
Really?
Yes. Very amusing. Clever, amusing, rather cynical, delightful, infinitely gifted man.
You enjoyed meeting him?
Very, very much.
He was in 45. You met him first?
In 45. Okay. And afterwards in 63, I think.
He came here?
Yes. He had an honorary degree. He was a very, very amusing, clever man. He was a writer of genius of children's verse.
Yes.
Best in our century by far. Marvelous. And an excellent literary historian. And witty, amusing man. He came to dinner with us, with Obolensky from here.
Dimitri.
Yes. He said to Obolensky and me, love the Soviet Union. Why don't you love it? Love it. That's the kind of man.
Uh-huh. Now, and did she mainly speak or did she ask you, Chukovskaya?
Oh, goodness, no. She mainly talked. I let her drive in. No, I don't think she wanted to know much about the West. She knew what she wanted to know. No, she just chatted away. Told me about the whole entourage, how it was, and how it all was in Peredelkino, where they all lived and so on. Then I saw another lady called Tomashevskaya. In Leningrad also talked to me about Pasternak, Akhmatova, the pianist Richter, and the whole circle.
Who is Tomaszewska?
She is the daughter. No, but Brodsky told me to go and see her. Uh-huh. Was he the poet? Uh-huh. And
did you see him before you went?
Yes, I do probably. I telephoned him when I saw him.
You meet him?
He's in London at the moment.
He's
in New York, normally. He's the best living. By far the best living Russian poet. By far. I went to Tomaszewskaya, and she was charming. And she was the daughter of adopted daughter of a famous Russian Shakespearean critic called Tomaszewski, who was one of the leading critics, was dead. And she told me a very amusing story. She said that Pasternak didn't really enjoy having birthdays too much. But he was finally persuaded to have a birthday celebration, a little kind of dinner. And so the friends were invited. Of course, Akhmatova was there, and Tomaszewskaya was there. and widows of two executed Armenian poets were there. And then Pastrnak was shyly, and Richter, the pianist, was there. And then he rather shyly said, there are two men who I would like you to ask. One is Wesnitsensky, the other is...